Showtime Sports presents Showtime Boxing with Eric Raskin and Kieran Mulvaney.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. With my co-host Eric Raskin, I am Kieran Mulvaney. And don't worry, folks. Before this podcast posted, the Nevada State Athletic Commission gave it a careful listen, replayed it several times to check for accuracy, went away, had a cup of coffee, came back, looked at video of themselves listening to the podcast, checking it for accuracy, and they've given it, after 3.5 hours, the thumbs up. So you can rest assured we've got everything right this episode. No chance whatsoever of a mistake slipping by that outfit.
You know, us parents like to lecture our kids about how you can get something done quickly or you can get it done right. This mess with the Nevada Athletic Commission was proof that it's possible to go 0-for-2. You can take your time and then some and still get it wrong. You can be inefficient and ineffective. In case anyone didn't see it, we are, of course, talking about the Joshua Franco-Andrew Maloney rematch. It was stopped after the second round because Franco's right eye had swollen shut. Referee Russell Mora had ruled that the eye injury came from a clash of heads, so it was going to be deemed a no contest. But they do use instant replay in Nevada. Actually, let me correct that. They use replay. There's nothing instant about it. So Bob Bennett and Robert Byrd spent 26 minutes watching replays and slow-mos of Maloney landing numerous jabs to that eye, but not a single clash of heads occurring in that area, and determined somehow that Mora was right. It was a clash of heads, no contest. Now, would it have been very unlucky for Franco to take an L because a punch landed in a freak way on his eye and caused it to swell shut? Absolutely. But I'll take bad luck determining the outcome over a bad call.
Right.
This was an embarrassment for the sport. I can't imagine any casual viewers sticking around for the main event. I would assume even some hardcore fans gave up and changed the channel at some point during this debacle. You know, the Nevada Commission used to be considered the gold standard. Not anymore. How do you get a call this wrong with the aid of replay? But I will say, I envy you, Kieran. I know that you watched this the next morning with access to a fast-forward button. So please tell me your suffering was a little more brief than mine.
Well, yes, and you had kind of hinted at it that you know, when I said I was just about to watch it, you did sort of hint that there would be very good opening banter material and told me roughly when in the broadcast it would be. So, yeah, I don't know. I saw some wag on Twitter say that they thought that the they were taking all that time to look at the replay to make sure that the UFC main event finished before they actually went to the ESPN. Yeah, you had to think about it for a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, had to flash back to what that was a reference to. But if it's not one thing, it's another.
Boxing. Yes, well, what are you going to do? Indeed. Right. But we can at least, you know, for all that Bob Arum complained about Vegas and said that this was it, he was done with Vegas, he was going to get the F out of Vegas. Oh, we can take that with a very large amount of salt, I think, actually. The very first fight for which I was actually credentialed was the Oscar De La Hoya-Shane Mosley match. And thus, my very first ever post-fight podcast had Bob Arum saying, I'm done with Vegas. I'm never coming back here. So,
yeah, that's nothing is ever new in boxing or with Bob Arum. It's, it's all cyclical.
Indeed. So let's look ahead and see what else is afoot in the boxing world. And coming up on this episode, we're going to look at some of the news of the week. We will be particularly picking apart the latest innovation, shall we say, from a certain Mexico City-based sanctioning organization. And we will talk to our boss, Steven Espinoza, the president of sports and event programming at Showtime. But first, let's catch up on the rest of the weekend's action. There wasn't too much of note to discuss. There were a couple of fights worthy of mention, and we begin in Las Vegas. And the main event of the aforementioned card, featuring Joshua Franco and Andrew Maloney, featuring a current and former top dog in the welterweight division. And in that fight, former champ Kell Brook started solidly against current main man Terence Crawford, working behind a strong jab to cause a slight mouse on Crawford's right eye. But Crawford is a notoriously slow starter, and by round three, he appeared to be getting into his groove. Even so, the end still seemed to come somewhat out of the blue, Crawford landing a southpaw right jab slash hook that Brook evidently just didn't see coming and actually moved right into. Brook staggered into the ropes, Referee Tony Weeks ruling a knockdown because those ropes held him up. Crawford immediately went back to work and finished the job just a few seconds later. Weeks stepped in to halt the contest at 1 minute 14 of round 4. Brooke falls to 39-3 with 27 KOs. Crawford climbs to 37-0 with 28 KOs. Eric, happy with the stoppage? And did you think in those early stages that maybe an upset might be on the cards? Or did it always feel to you as if this was just a matter of time until Crawford got into the rhythm of things and took over?
So on the first question, definitely nothing to argue with on the stoppage. Brooke was pretty well out of it, and Crawford is an elite finisher. Now, maybe if there had been just 5 or 10 seconds left on the clock in the round, you could make a case for seeing if he can get through it. But there was like a minute 45 left, so easy call for Weeks there, I thought. As for what happened before that, in the first three rounds, did I think Brooke had a shot? No. Not really. You know, I was not expecting the ending to come this soon and this suddenly. I expected Crawford to stop him in the mid to late rounds. But, you know, even though I gave Brooke the first two rounds, I never thought Crawford was in any danger, never doubted for a minute that he would take over whenever he was good and ready. This was more or less the fight we were expecting. We know Brooke is a world-class fighter, if a few years past his best. We expected him to have some moments, maybe win some rounds. He has a good jab. He's well-schooled and reasonably fast. And Crawford, as you said, can be a slow starter. So there was no need to overreact to him indeed getting off to a slow start. It was actually a bit like the election. You know, every media outlet I followed leading up to the election warned of a red mirage. It will look like Trump is in the lead early in states that don't allow mail-in ballots to be counted in advance. And as the votes are all counted, it will swing back to Biden. This is what we were told. That doesn't mean I didn't let emotion rule over logic for a few hours there. But logically, I knew this is more or less following the script. Same thing here. If I had bet $1,000 on Crawford, I might have gotten emotional and panicked in the first round or two, but I had no such investment, no need to get emotional. So my mind stayed on track with what I knew going in, that there was a possibility of a Brooke mirage early, which was good for Crawford in the sense that Brooke had a chance to remind people he's a solid fighter before Crawford blew him out, thus making the win feel not entirely meaningless for Bud. But, you know, does that mean it was actually meaningful? Does it elevate him at all? Pound-for-pound rankings got shaken up following Vasily Lomachenko's loss to Teofimo Lopez the other week. And most observers now have Bud or Canelo Alvarez at number one, with a handful going with Inoue. But it's mostly a Bud versus Canelo debate, which is essentially an eye test versus resume debate. Where do you stand on that, Kieran? Did Saturday night make any difference in how you view it? And amid reports of Crawford being unhappy with his lack of big fights, what do you see as being next for him?
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
So Saturday night didn't make any difference for me, actually, one way or the other. I have frequently joked, you know, when Vasily Lomachenko was at his peak, that I thought Terence Crawford was the best human being boxing in the world.
Right.
I continue to feel that way. You know, I've thought he was special, you know, ever since, you know, he showed up on HBO at the end of 2012, believe it or not. It's hard to believe that 8 years have elapsed since then. You know, 8 years in which he simultaneously established himself as, at the very least, one of the best boxers in the world. And yet, during which he's also continued to feel as if he's still struggling to become as fully established as his talent sort of suggests he should be. Obviously, the ongoing narrative to move on to, you know, what's next. The ongoing narrative about Crawford for some time now has been that search for a defining fight. And, you know, and the strength of Canelo's claim to the number one pound for pound spot, as you said, is that he's had so many of those defining fights. We know how good Canelo is because he has tested himself against the very best, and Crawford just hasn't had that opportunity. Even though when we have seen him, whoever he's been up against, like you said, he's in many ways a complete fighter, a switch hitter, excellent boxer, good defense. fans, and also these days a power puncher. It seems like such a long time that he was considered to be a bit of a boring technical boxer. He's on an 8-fight KO streak now. You know, what's interesting to me in terms of like what's next, of course, during the days building up to this fight, there was quite a lot of talk about a growing rift between Crawford and Bob Arum. Crawford, The Athletic reporting that Crawford apparently unhappy about the fact that he hasn't had the defining big fight against an Errol Spence or Danny Garcia or Manny Pacquiao. And interestingly, after the fight, Arum fought back, asking rhetorically, you know, whether he was the one who should want to continue with Crawford,
right.
Claiming that Crawford fights losing money, putting a lot of the blame on Crawford himself for being terrible at promoting fights. As someone who interviewed Bud many times during fight weeks, I can confirm he's awful. you know, after a while, he gets to know you and he feels comfortable with you. He might open up a bit, but man, it's hard work. And he doesn't like doing interviews. He won't do them now with any journalist or broadcaster who he thinks may have disrespected him. He says that. He says that like that's his policy. If you said bad things about him, he won't talk to you. That's just not the way it works. you're going to end up talking to very few people. I remember being a bit surprised when he did re-up with Top Rank in 2018. You know, they were definitely, you know, making eyes at Eddie Hearn the previous year. And I thought that that's where he was going to go. At the moment, it doesn't feel as if their arrangement will sort of extend past its expiry date in October 2021, apparently. But who knows? A lot can happen in 11 months. So what exactly do I think will be happening? I was very surprised to hear from Crawford and other reporting that allegedly he and Manny Pacquiao were very close to an agreement to fight in the Middle East until COVID messed things up. I was really surprised to hear that. I have no earthly idea why Pacquiao would want that fight.
Right.
You and I have talked about this matchup so many times over the years, and Crawford brings, from a Pacquiao perspective, he brings nothing to the table in terms of money, and he brings so much danger. But there's talk about perhaps trying to go ahead and make that fight. If it can happen for Crawford, it will be better for him than if it had happened 15, 18 months ago, because Pacquiao's win over Keith Thurman has kind of shown that he might not be the force that he was, but he's still obviously a major force in the welterweight division. So, you know, that's obviously the fight that can be made right now while Crawford's at Top Rank, seeing as Pacquiao's apparently a free agent, that will give him the sort of exposure and money that he wants. If I were Terence Crawford, I'd be doing everything I can to make that fight. But to be fair to Bob Arum, Terence, that includes doing a lot of media interviews to bang that drum to make that happen. So I don't know, but that's, at the moment, seems to be the most viable possibility for him to get that big fight. Although, as I said, I just don't understand why Pacquiao would want it.
Right. I'm just glad that not every boxer in the world has the same policy as Crawford, because if every boxer I'd ever made a snarky tweet or snarky comment on a podcast about refused to talk to me, I would probably be done interviewing boxers.
Exactly. But, oh, well, there you go. It's his right, I suppose. It's up to him. But there you go. Yeah. We said not too much action that weekend, but across the pond, Katie Taylor did return to the ring atop a 3-fight card of women's boxing on DAZN. And after a pair of hard battles against Delphine Persson in her last 3 fights, this was a much easier outing for Taylor. She dominated Miriam Gutierrez to retain her undisputed lightweight title by unanimous decision. Scores were 100-89, 100-90, and 99-91. One judge somehow finding a round for Gutierrez in there. Taylor was just simply a class or two above here, wasn't she? I mean, and were you at all surprised? You know, she rocked Gutierrez in the she came after her right at the opening bell, rocked her in the third with a left hook, dropped her at the end of the fourth, had her pinned against the ropes in the sixth. Any surprise that actually this ended up going to a decision?
Maybe a slight surprise, because it did seem like Taylor was on her way to stopping Gutierrez in those middle rounds. But Katie Taylor isn't a knockout artist, never has been, just 6 KOs in 17 fights. Although, as we say about Clarissa Shields, it's a little harder to rack up KOs when you're fighting these 2-minute rounds. Regardless of whether or not she got the knockout, what a dazzling performance by Katie Taylor. Yeah. She looked absolutely fantastic. So different from her 2 fights with Delphine Persoon.
Yeah.
She was able to completely have her way against Gutierrez and show off all her offensive and defensive abilities. And so I'm left still a bit undecided about just how good she is. maybe Persoon is that good. And, you know, Katie Taylor is the Mayweather of women's boxing, and she met her Jose Luis Castillo. That's a reach, of course. You know, she's not a Floyd Mayweather, but you get the analogy. Katie Taylor is probably in the top three pound for pound among female fighters right now, and Persoon might be top five or six. You know, so based on what we saw against Gutierrez, I would believe that. Taylor looked tremendous. Full toolbox, as Roy Jones would say.
Indeed.
But, you know, but maybe Gutierrez is just that limited. Can't really say for sure. I'll say this for Katie Taylor. What a charming personality. I watched and listened to a couple of interviews with her this week. Just seems like such a humble, down-to-earth person, so easy to root for. If she and Clarissa Shields are the two faces of women's boxing for the next 5 years or so, the sport is in good hands and will continue to grow.
Yeah. She's another one who hates doing media, you know. They had to really work on her, I think, because she's just quite quiet and shy. She just likes to get in and fight, and that's it. And it's a pity, because when she does get to speak to the media, she's great. She's lovely.
You
definitely want to root for Katie Taylor. But, yeah, I kind of think after watching those two Delphine Persoon fights that Persoon's just the kind of fighter who is just going to make life miserable for whoever fights her. Mm-hmm. I think just that crowding, difficult style. So I'm sure Taylor was relieved to be fighting Miriam Gutierrez on Saturday night.
Yeah.
Let's go!
It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount+. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
All right, let's move on. We are joined right now by a man who, I think with his third appearance on the pod this year, is really cementing his place atop the leaderboard of guest appearances on Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. And that's appropriate, because he pays for Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. It is, of course, the president of sports and event programming at Showtime, Stephen Espinoza.
Gentlemen, how are you? I'm doing great. Quite an introduction there. I will refrain from comment.
We are paid directly out of your pocket, right?
Yes,
that's how it works.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And the more nice things we say.
I'm a little short this week. I hope you guys don't mind.
Oh, no.
We can talk about that off air. Don't worry about it.
Okay, I might have to cancel my Amazon purchases, but we'll do what we can. All right. So look, the last time we spoke with you, it was just after you made the announcement of Showtime's late summer and fall slate of shows. It was an ambitious schedule, almost complete now. We'll ask you to look back on a few of the specific cards in a bit.
Okay.
But in general, what has been your sort of big picture view about how everything has gone? And have the logistical challenges sort of been along the lines of what you expected? And have you learned anything that you weren't expecting to learn over the last few months?
Good questions. I think the logistical challenges were all sort of in the pre-setup, you know, in figuring out what's going on. Once it's up and running, it's sort of runs itself, and you sort of get used to it in a way. I think what people don't really realize is that the sacrifices that both the fighters and their camps and the production people make. So everybody's protocols are slightly different. For ours, depending, we had different ones in Connecticut than we did in Texas, and those are because of the commissions. But in Connecticut, basically, you could leave your room during the week to get takeout from the casino. You could walk outside, but beyond that, you know, nothing. So there's no group meals, there's no gym, there's no exercising, certainly no casino. And that's not too bad if you're getting in, you know, Thursday, Friday. If you're in earlier because you're doing setup or something like that, then you're in Monday, Tuesday, and it's you know, it's sort of like solitary confinement, but in a really nice minimum security prison. So I think, look, it's definitely worth it. You know, on the production side, we haven't had, you know, knock on wood, cross your fingers and all of that. We haven't had a positive yet with Showtime Boxing. And that's great, because that's the largest group. That can be 75, 80 people or more. We have had some positives on the fighter side. You know, obviously the very first one was Stephen Fulton, which was as soon as he arrived in the bubble. And thankfully, the other ones, and not thankfully that there were positives, but thankfully the other ones were caught relatively early, at least a week or two ahead of 5 weeks, so we can make adjustments. So I think all in all, if you had told me this is where we'd be at sort of this point in the year, I would have taken it hands down. I would have been thrilled.
Right. So turning to some of the specifics, the biggest event was the six fight double main event pay-per-view card featuring the Charlo brothers. Obviously, there were unique circumstances behind that one. But now that you've done it and know what's involved, is that the kind of thing you might experiment with again in the future?
If I did, I might want to throw a six rounder in there a little bit.
Okay.
I think that's where the challenge was. As we saw with the tank, when you get some stoppages, you know, both from the excitement and the adrenaline standpoint, and just from the length of the show standpoint, it really helps the pace. So when you're getting to your fourth or fifth fight of the night, and you're talking about 10 or 12 rounds, even for the hardest core fan, that's tough. So I would say, you know, maybe we break it up into two shows, you know, an afternoon and then take a break and then come back. Or, you know, maybe it's, you know, five instead of six. But I don't think we'll have quite that set of details and elements together yet again. But I think that was the one thing about it is I think even the hardest court fight then, it was a long, long time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it was moving along nicely in the first half, and then got a few that went the distance, and suddenly it's getting late for that main event, which is of course the Achilles heel for East Coasters, washed East Coasters like me and Kieran.
No, I'm in that category now because I used to, and you know it's amazing. I haven't spent most of my career, most of my adult life on the West Coast. You're used to people on the East Coast whining about it. It's just, oh yeah. And now you get out there and all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, they actually had a point. It actually is really a drag. The World Series is on at 1 a.m. and you're sitting there with fights at 12:30 waiting for a main event.
Yep.
It's something that, you know, look, you've got the competition with other major sporting events, which is worse than usual this year. And that's always, you know, balances one way. But I mean, it is something that I think the sport really needs to think about a lot. Because I think the good thing on that Charlo doubleheader was that it started early. And I think there was a lot of positive feedback around that early start.
Yeah. And staying with that card, how did you feel about, you know, how things went for the A-side guys in the main event for the two Charlo brothers? You know, I think we went into that feeling that they both were looking to make a real statement win. Do you feel they both got a statement win?
I think without question. I think they showed everything that I think their fans and their supporters had hoped they would. And it was some really entertaining bouts. I mean, you know, looking back on the Derevyanchenko-Charlo fight, that fight was about as high a level as a boxer-slugger type matchup you get, because it wasn't just a bar fight, you know, it wasn't a tough man competition. There was real skill in it, but it was still two guys slugging it out. And I thought that was, I mean, if we could have every fight, you know, for a year that way, I mean, you know, the sport would be all the better for it, because I think, you know, for my particular taste, you had enough of the skilled boxing and enough of the slugging that it was really, really entertaining. You know, and really, really, for a fight that sort of, it's also a good example of a fight that, you know, if you look at the scorecards, it's deceiving, because, you know, you might be up 5-2 or, and they're all just barely. So it feels like an even fight when you're watching it on the scorecards. You know, you can have one guy up by 3 or 4 points. Right. It doesn't look so close.
Right. What do you want to see next for both the brothers?
Well, I think for Jermell, I think you have to go for the fourth belt. I mean, that's really the fight. And I think we got a little bit of clarity now that we have a tentative date with Castaño and Teixeira. Out of that fight, whoever wins that, I think that's the natural fight. And to have, you know, a four belt champion in the 154 pound division, we've been sort of talking about it for 2 or 3 years now. It would. I think that's the that has to be the fight to commit.
How about Jamal?
Jamal's an you know, an interesting one. I think you know, he's got some you know, I think there's some guys who may be moving up. He may be moving up. I think he's got some interesting choices. You know, looking forward. I think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with the zone fighters. You know, and you know, there's some of our colleagues have wanted very much to see an Andre fight, but I think, you know, I think that one is past his prime. There have been opportunities to make that. So I'm not optimistic about that one. You know, I still hold out hope, you know, in the long run, particularly now with Canelo out there as a free agent, that there can be a Charlo Canelo fight at 168. Mm. And I think that's probably, when you look at both Jamal and Canelo, I think that's got to be top of the list for the most intriguing fights for either one right now.
Definitely. Turning to the other big pay-per-view card that you've recently done, Gervonta Davis knocked out Leo Santa Cruz in the main event. Given everything, the quality of the opposition and of the fight, the explosiveness of the knockout, and the fact that knockout video went viral, you know, millions and millions of views on social media, was this everything you hoped it would be? And do you believe this will be the launching pad for Tank to the next level as an attraction?
It's a huge step for Tank. And, you know, having said what I just said about Charlo Derevyanchenko, I'll say the same thing. I mean, the kind of action that we got in that brief burst between Tank and Leo was high level stuff. And I don't think that anyone expected Leo to come in the way he did and to, you know, in spurts, stand toe to toe and exchange with Tank and hold his own, you know, and, you know, ultimately, you know, you relax for a second or you make a mistake and, you know, you pay the price against a guy like Tank. But I think overall, the main event overshadowed some really interesting performances. The Barrios Carl was really entertaining, you know, confirmed what we thought about Barrios. He's rarely in a boring fight. Then, you know, we go to Regis Progre, and he looked as sharp and strong as he has in a while. And then Isaac Cruz, I think quietly is a guy who people should watch.
So obviously one of the key elements of that pay-per-view is it was the first main card in this country to be in front of a paying crowd since we've had the pandemic. And afterwards, Eric and I were discussing, you know, whether it was possible that this was, you know, the start of something, the first of several. But I sort of ventured that I had a feeling that maybe you just happened to catch a small perfect window in time because it felt as if the virus is about to get much worse. And lo and behold, that's really where we are here, that things are getting out of control. Look, obviously, I'm not going to ask you to try and predict the passage of the pandemic, but it's pretty obvious that we're not going to get any federal action, at least until January 20th. Does it feel that way to you? Do you feel that like that was probably the one opportunity we've had for fights in front of crowds for at least a couple of months?
You know, it very well might be. You know, what's going on is scary. We certainly don't want to put anyone in harm's way. And that includes the crowd. You know, I'm not sure how much it came across on television. There was a lot of space. I mean, this wasn't... you know, I was struck, you know, having watched the Crawford fight over the weekend. And I know they did rapid tests and everything, you know, before, but there wasn't a lot of space in here. But we had, you know, huge gaps in space in that arena. And that's what you can do when you're in a 70,000 seat arena. But having said that, you know, I think there's a lot of sensitivity to whether we would go back in the environment that we're in now, which was is very different now sitting here 2 weeks after the fact than it was then.
Yeah.
So, but I was struck, you know, immediately by the value of the crowd. It really added a whole dimension. It was 9,000 people. It sounded like, you know, 79 or 89. Promise you, we didn't pump it up. We didn't supplement it. That was legitimate crowd noise. It was the loudest 9,000 seat crowd that I've ever heard, you know, and probably some that was the acoustics and echoing within a really big Alamo Dome. But it was, it would have, definitely the fight would have felt different without that element.
You know?
And it just reinforced how much we all miss it, I think.
Yeah. Yes. But it felt like that crowd was there from the very beginning. And I also don't know if that's because they had to be let in at a certain time or whatever, but it felt like there was an energy there for the whole card.
There was an energy there. I mean, look, I've been a lot of places and we'll see if this is going to turn out to be a trend. Again, I'm not sure if you caught this on air, but anytime they showed Floyd on the Jumbotron, there was just like a drowning in boos. I mean, it was sort of like going to an NBA game, you know, when you're booing one guy who whenever he gets the ball.
Right.
That's what it was on Floyd. It was a really engaged crowd. It was a lot of fun.
As we discussed with you last time, and as you mentioned already here, you've had contingencies in place for every card in the event that any boxers had to drop out due to COVID. And you mentioned what happened with Stephen Fulton being unable to go up against Angelo Leo in a fight many of us were greatly looking forward to. There are reports now that the fight could be on for December. What can you tell us about that?
I think that's more likely an early 2021 fight. I'm aware of the reports. There have been some conflicting information, both internally and publicly, about the availability of Ubali for the Donaire fight. You know, and I can't speak knowledgeably on some of that because we're still sort of sorting all of it out. But our goal is to, you know, hopefully keep Donaire on that show and get a high level opponent. And possibly even keeping as the title fight, and we'll see. But I think even having said that, I think that the Fulton Leo is first quarter of 2021.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean and a woman named Sylvie.
She's a can model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire, now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Okay, so Rodriguez not necessarily confirmed as Donaire's opponent, is that correct?
I would love so. I don't believe there's a signed contract. You know, okay. Maybe it's happened today, so I never like to jinx things. But that's a situation where, it's arguably as good a fight, if not better, in terms of the style matchup. So I think it takes a little bit of extra time and energy and commitment, but everyone understands, the fighters understand what's going on here, and you never know, you could get an opportunity for a title shot out of the blue, and that may drop into Rodriguez's lap here.
So you know, Leo looked terrific against Jermaine Williams, who did step into the spot there. And you know, you mentioned some of the guys on the undercard of the pay-per-views, and we've also seen, you know, during these fights over the last couple months, we've seen Brandon Lee score yet another first round knockout. Malik Hawkins maybe showing he needs to stick to some shallower waters. Xavier Martinez going through an amazing gut check and coming through on the other side. Who, you know, and a lot of these guys we've been watching on Showbox and on special editions and coming up, who has really sort of impressed you over these last several months in that kind
of thing? Well, you said Hawkins. I think Hawkins is still a good young prospect. But I think that fight was more about Matias. And him showing the potential that a lot of people thought he had coming up, and maybe shaking off a shaky performance or two in the past. But, you know, you talk about a guy who comes in with a seek and destroy mentality. That stuck with me. And the other one you mentioned as well, certainly Brandon Lee has been impressive, and I think we'll step him up in terms of quality opposition pretty quickly. But Xavier Martinez, that is, I'm not sure that Floyd wanted that tough a fight, and Floyd doesn't shy away from tough fights for any of his guys. But that is, you can't overestimate the value of that experience for a young fighter. And B, like I, you know, if you asked for one guy other than those pay-per-view high-level performances, one guy, it would be Xavier Martinez, because I think it was the seventh, was it the seventh or the eighth round? Him to survive the round and then come back and at least, I think on my card, I give him maybe three of the next four rounds, and most judges did. Like that, he just, you know, and I called Floyd during the 12th round of that fight. And I said, look, I don't know how this is going to end up. I have no idea what the scores, but I wanted to see this kid again, you know, win or lose, because he's earned it. You know, you show that kind of heart, it would have been really easy for a young guy to pack it up. Yes. And, you know, especially against a veteran like Marrero. But he didn't. And that was one of the most impressive performances of, you know, of this quarter.
All right. So we have all these young guys that hopefully we'll be seeing again in 2021. You already mentioned Fulton Leo, hopefully in the works for first quarter of 2021. This year from hell is finally coming to a close. So we can sort of start to think more about 2021. I assume you're deep into planning for the new calendar year. Is there anything else beyond those names that is coming together that you can share with us? And I'm particularly curious about Clarissa Shields. Anything in the works with her?
Yeah, you know, we're talking to Dimitri. Look, you know, part of the difficulty here, you know, and I'm sure you guys and others have put two and two together on some of the other cards. You know, we haven't had as many show boxes we would have liked. We haven't had any, you know, as some of the mid-level shows that that we would have liked. And that's simply because, you know, these the championship shows are a lot more expensive than we anticipated. Mm-hmm. And it's all in sort of testing and extra days of hotel and quarantine and all of that. So as we're going in and you have a fixed sum of money going into the third and fourth quarter, you know, I'd hope to do more shows, but it turns out, you know, once the bill started coming in, you know, we couldn't do a lot beyond the big championship shows. So I think that that will change going forward, both in terms of show box and in terms of other things, you know, possibly Clarissa. You know, obviously she's got an interesting fight lined up. Dimitri and I continue to talk and try and figure that out. And then otherwise, you know, look, David Benavidez is a guy who sort of kicked off the schedule for us back in August. You know, I think we'll start and go back through again. So he's due another fight, whether it's, you know, Caleb Plant, who all of a sudden is sort of the belle of the ball in terms of, you know, getting opponents. His phone is ringing off the hook. And, you know, whether or not that's it, I think, you know, David is somebody who's always really entertaining. And I think a big focus for us going forward. I know your personal favorites will probably see Adrian Broner back. I know you've been waiting for me to say that with big
yes.
breath. And, you know, look, I think the Charlos, I think we might see, you know, I still think there's a lot of activity in the 47, 54, 60 division. You know, there are some guys who've been quiet, whether it's, you know, J-Rock or Hurd or those guys, I think, you know, we'll see them, you know, at some point in the first part of the year. And, you know, I think, again, you know, we've got down at 122 an embarrassment of Richards, you know, yes. there as well. I mean, so whether it's Brandon Figueroa and, you know, Luis Neri or Raiz Salim or, you know, any combination of those guys, I think you can't make a bad fight, you know, in that division. Right?
Yeah. Well, as long as you mentioned the name of Caleb Plant, I have to ask as a final question, I have to bring up, and you mentioned his name already yourself, Canelo Alvarez. We know that there were at least some talks going on with Showtime and Canelo. What are you able to say about how far anything progressed and whether there is a decent looking possibility that Canelo and Showtime might come together?
Well, you know, anybody who's knows anything about the sport, you know, is going to would be interested in Canelo if he becomes available. You know, that's sort of a given. So, you know, I'll say it. You know, we would very much like to have him back, and we think between us and PBC, there's some really interesting fights to be done. And I think we're the network that's, you know, best suited for what's going to happen going forward. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Canelo is very much his own boss. And he knows, you know, he's in that period of his career. And it's interesting to see fighters get to that point, because a lot of the high level fighters, they get to the point where they take the reins themselves. So, you know, we make our pitch, you know, and do the deal that we can defend and which makes sense for us and we think for him. And then he's got his own set of parameters in terms of the goals that he wants to get done. I think he wants to get back into the ring very quickly. And understandably, it's been a year since he's fought. So look, you know, whether it's on this fight or the next one, as long as he remains available, we'll keep pursuing him, because I think there's good fights to be made.
And you promise that you will never make him wait an hour and a half for a UFC main event to finish.
That is one thing, you know, that is one thing I can definitely promise. And, you know, I think, you know, we talk now, if I can get on my soapbox again, you know, I think, and I'm going to tell you, we haven't always handled this the best, you know, that Charlo doubleheader, I think, you know, it dragged the second half of it. But I really think, you know, not talking about any show in particular, although there are some recent ones that have, you know, I think as networks, we really need to be really careful. We have a responsibility to the sport to present it in the best way. And the best way is not a couple rounds of action and then an hour of talking. Now, I get it. Like, if you go fight, you're never going to entertain the casual fans, because you know, have no idea. You need to get people invested, let them know who's fighting, and let them get an emotional attachment. But that doesn't mean, you know, an endless series of, you know, features and anthems and all this kind of thing. Because I think when you've got something attractive, as we've tried to do on both the pay-per-views, we want to feel brisk. We want it to feel like, hey, this thing is moving, not let's get on to the next fight. So if there was a wish list for me for 2021, it would be all of us who participate in the sport could pay closer attention to that. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's one thing that really, I think, drags down the experience. If you just drag it out and have, you know, these interminable waits between fights, it's you can have the best fight in the world, and it's just going to have a negative taste in your mouth.
Yeah,
you're singing our song, Steve. Yeah,
that you are.
No, you guys are cranky guys just like me.
Exactly. hey, look, Stephen, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. And look, congratulations to you, to the crew, to all the production staff for pulling off the cards that you've done so far in this unbelievably difficult environment. And I think they've all, like you said, there've been some hiccups along the way, but of course there have. I think mm-hmm. a lot of credit is due to you and everybody else involved. It's been a really good series of fight cards. And we've still got a couple more before year's end as well. So
that's right.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, and, absolutely. Anytime, guys.
And thank you for those little envelopes of cash that you keep sending our way.
Right.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Steve.
All right. Thanks.
Just a few fights to look forward to this coming week. On Thursday, Ring City makes its debut on NBC Sportsnet with a doubleheader featuring Oshaki Foster against Mickey Roman in junior lightweight action, and lightweights William Zepeda against Roberto Ramirez. On Saturday, Javier Fortuna takes on Antonio Lozada on Fox Sports 1, and Conor Benn, son of Nigel, meets Sebastian Formella on DAZN. And somehow Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. gets another fight, although, thank heavens, this one is not on any TV or streaming service in the US. Anything float your boat there, Eric?
Definitely not Chavez Jr. That boat has sunken. The DAZN card, you know, Ben is a somewhat interesting prospect, but I'm not building my Saturday afternoon around watching that card. Same goes for Fortuna Lozada. I'll wait and see if the internet is abuzz afterward about some instant classic fight that I missed. The one I'll be making a point to watch live is the NBC Sports card, because I'm curious to see how Ring City looks, how fights from the wildcard gym look. We'll have some friends on the broadcast team. We're friendly with the guys behind Ring City. So we'll be wishing them all well and wanting to see how this new show goes. And the fights are solid, you know, when you're talking about low-budget fights. It's a showbox level, although without the emphasis on prospect versus prospect. Mickey Roman is certainly nobody's idea of a prospect. But I like that matchup with Oshaki Foster. Zepeda Ramirez looks good on paper too. I like that they're doing it on Thursday. That's a nice change of pace. I'd love to see boxing reclaim a midweek evening. Hasn't really done that since USA Tuesday Night Fights ended, so maybe Ring City can change that. So yeah, mark me down as a very interested observer on Thursday. Nothing much else to care about this coming weekend, though. What the schedule lacks in fights right now in mid-November, we make up for with news items, a fair number of them to go over this week. And we begin with the biggest and most persistent one. We already talked to Steven about this. It is, of course, the saga of Canelo Alvarez. When we recorded last week, it appeared he was set to fight Caleb Plant, and we were hearing that Showtime was a front runner to televise. Now the reports have him heading back to DAZN, at least for this one fight, for about half the money he was owed under the deal he just got out of, to take on Callum Smith. Kieran, anything to add to what Steven was able to share with us? And what are your thoughts on this latest chapter in the Canelo saga?
So on one level, like out of context, the Zone looks a lot smarter than it did a week ago. You know, if it's rid of Golden Boy, at least in terms of Canelo, and can now deal with him directly and can offer him 16 to 20 million instead of 35 to 40 million, that's theoretically good business. My suspicion is this is a one-off. That it's just that, like, as we talked about last week, Canelo just really wants to fight, and he really wanted to fight this year. And there's probably more money and probably more opportunity to make the fight immediately with DAZN. Well, there just wasn't enough time to turn around like a pay-per-view, especially as, you know, some other promoters have moved away from fights on that sort of December 19th date because of it going head-to-head with other sports. So I suspect we'll see something different next year. I don't think we're just going to see Canelo back in a relationship with DAZN for half the money he was going to get. Right. But we shall see. The only thing that is more guaranteed than us talking about Canelo inside the ring is talking about Canelo and his fight negotiations and contract situation and promotional situation. It feels like it has been the big ongoing joke almost on the podcast for a year now, actually,
right?
I think. But if Canelo's next fight is an ongoing topic for his discussion, so is that of Tyson Fury, who in the latest twist, having insisted that he wanted to fight in 2020, that he needed to fight in 2020, has now tweeted, as has his promoter, that he won't, after all, in fact, be fighting in 2020, that he will be back in 2021. So make of that what you will, in light of, for example, mediation talks between him and Deontay Wilder regarding a possible third fight and various other things that are afoot. It certainly sounds as if something is afoot there. We talked earlier with Steven about fights being postponed or cancelled due to COVID, and Luke Campbell's title eliminator with Ryan Garcia has been postponed as well after the British boxer tested positive. What are your levels of bummed outness about a delay in that fight, Eric?
It is a bummer for sure, although there's talk that it might only be delayed 2 weeks, in which case can't get too upset about that. Right. I just hope Luke Campbell is at 100% when it happens. We want to see that fight, and we don't want asterisks around that result.
Indeed.
Now, here's a news item that caught me by surprise. Roc Nation has announced that it is leaving the boxing business. Jay-Z's company made a lot of noise when it entered the promotional game in 2014, signing the likes of Andre Ward and Miguel Cotto to big money contracts. But here's why the news caught me by surprise. Both Ward and Cotto have been retired for a few years, And I had no idea Roc Nation was even still in the boxing business. It's like when I heard Brian Dennehy died earlier this year, and I was taken by surprise because I was certain, for whatever reason, that he was already dead. That's sort of where I was with Roc Nation. Did you know that Roc Nation was still alive as a boxing promoter? And any parting thoughts about their involvement in the sport?
No, not that I'd actually thought about Roc Nation for a long time. Right. I just assumed they were long gone. You know, when they were around, I enjoyed working with them. I enjoyed working with Michael Yormark, who headed up that division. But they never felt like they were really on top of things in terms of being a promotional company. For a start, Jay-Z never put them in a position to take advantage of their biggest asset, which was Jay-Z. He would never tweet about his company's fights, would never talk about them, would never do any publicity. Was rarely, if ever, at those fights, I feel. So, you know, they had and went through some boxing, real boxing expertise. But they did make the mistake, I think, that DAZN would arguably later follow, which was to enter by throwing vast amounts, too much money, at the sport and at the people that they wanted to sign. I mean, there were huge deals that they signed Ward and Kodo too. Boxing promotion's hard. It takes a lot. Everybody thinks they can be a promoter, but it takes a lot of smarts and expertise, as well as, you know, an ability to maybe turn off the ethics filter from time to time, as well as money, of course. And of course, Roc Nation, you know, they lost a lot of goodwill in the sport with the situation regarding one of their fighters, Daniel Twitch Franco. Franco ultimately suing Roc Nation after he suffered brain injuries in a pair of bouts, actually, that he claims the promoter pushed him into, and that sort of left a bad taste, and it felt as if Roc Nation was never really much of a force after that, and certainly not after, you know, Kodo left and then Andre retired. So yeah, there you go. Goodbye, Roc Nation. You knew. Yeah. All right. Okay. We're saving this one for last because this is boxing at its most boxing. We started with boxing being boxing at the top of the podcast. It seems fair that we're coming around to the uniqueness of this particular sport. So one of the sanctioning bodies has announced that it is creating a new division between cruiserweight and heavyweight, which it claims is a response to the inherent unfairness of 201-pound heavyweights having to compete with the likes of 270-pound Tyson Fury. This division, which has a specified upper limit of 224 pounds, is already in that organization's rankings, and it is called Bridgerweight. Why, you ask, is it called Bridgerweight? Is it because it is a bridge between smaller fighters and super heavyweight behemoths? No. It is named after a six-year-old boy called Bridger. I am not making this up. Bridger sounds like a great kid. He saved his four-year-old sister from an attack by a wild dog, an unbelievably heroic effort by the young man. Clearly worthy of reward and recognition, but really, why taint it by associating his name with this cesspool of a concept? Look, and far be it for me to suggest this whole thing's been thrown together without any real thought, but the head of said sanctioning body initially said that the cruiserweight division would remain untouched, and then just 3 days after that, decided that cruiserweight's limit would be moved back down to its original weight of 190 pounds, and the Bridgerweight would start there. Also, anyone ranked in the Bridgerweight rankings is completely able to fight for heavyweight belts if they so choose. So, I don't know. Look, maybe I've just been around this sport too long, and I'm just a simple small-town boxing podcaster, Eric, but it almost makes it sound as if this is merely a desperate grab for more sanctioning fees. That can't be right, can it?
No, can't be. The alphabets are in it for purely altruistic reasons, as we all know. Setting aside whether boxing needs another division, you can immediately see the problems this will cause if one sanctioning body has a 224-pound division and the others don't. And if one says cruiserweight has a limit of 190 and the others say it's 200.
Yeah.
We don't need to make this sport more confusing and chaotic than it already is, but these greedy bastards are trying to do just that. The main reason that smaller heavyweights, guys in the 200-pound range, move up from cruiserweight is the prestige and money that come with fighting for the heavyweight championship of the world. I can tell you, without knowing him personally or ever asking him about it, that Oleksandr Usyk has no desire to be the Bridgerweight champion.
Exactly.
That's not what's driving him. This is so stupid. I get it. There are a couple of outliers, Fury and Joshua specifically, who are a tall task, pun somewhat intended, for the 220-pound heavyweights. So what? Those are the measuring sticks that Usyk and Wilder and Povetkin want to compete against. Until you can show me that the best 220-pounders don't want to face the best 250-pounders, I will view this purely as a division that exists to put a belt on the best of the second or maybe third tier 220-pounders. Yeah. That guy who has given up on competing with the best heavyweights and is happy to collect any belt he can get his hands on at this stage of his career. Like, creating a Bridgerweight division, this is basically a way for Bryant Jennings to have a shot at a belt. Not to knock Bryant Jennings, but that's kind of the level of fighter that is going to gravitate toward having some interest in this, fighting at 224 pounds for a title. And let me remind you, just a few months ago, 224-pound Alexander Povetkin, a couple weeks shy of his 41st birthday, knocked 252-pound Dillian Whyte cold. Why do 224-pounders need their own division again? Yeah. I rest my case.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's funny. I'm not necessarily an absolutist on the issue of weight classes. I mean, less is more. I don't inherently mind necessarily, say, 15 weight divisions rather than 8 if there's one champion in each of those weight divisions. Mm-hmm. And weight limits are somewhat arbitrary. But, I mean, come on. You can't keep, especially when it comes to the upper weight divisions, if you start dividing these divisions into 10 or 15 pound increments, you'll never end. And maybe I shouldn't say that because I don't want to give these people any
yep,
ideas.
They're on it.
And I actually made note to use that very same example that you just talked about, that the head of this sanctioning body actually offered the issue of Alexander Usyk appearing to be somewhat physically overmatched throughout the first two rounds of his fight with Derek Teixeira as a reason for having this division. But Usyk won the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looked the more likely to score the knockout. And the note that I also made is he's not doing this to become Bridgerweight champion. Right. He was doing very well as a cruiserweight champion and he could have stayed there, but he wants to be heavyweight champion. And if you move the bottom of the heavyweight division to 224 pounds, then those guys who are 210 pounds are going to try to get up to 224 pounds to be heavyweight. They're not going to pay any attention to Bridgerweight at yeah. all. But, and also, just the name. I mean, Jesus, how yeah. far up your own ass do you have to be to think, oh, what a lovely, charming story of a childhood hero. I shall unilaterally create a weight division in boxing to honor him. I mean, good Lord. Oh, and sort of related to, on the same level as your Alexander Povetkin thing, one man who has fought almost his entire career within the Bridgerweight limits is Deontay Wilder.
Yep, yep.
The one time in the last few years he exceeded the Bridgerweight weight division to become a heavyweight, he got his ass kicked in his last fight.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's better off at the lighter weight. So, yeah, it's I would love to be able to say, well, it's just one sanctioning body that's gone rogue. But as soon as the others see that there's money involved, we know what's going to happen.
Right. That's why we got to nip this in the bud before it really takes hold at all. Deontay Wilder, of course, could not make Bridgerweight if he has his 40-pound ring walk suit on. Indeed. So very important distinction there when he does step on the scale. You know, I agree with what you said about that these weight limits are somewhat arbitrary and not etched in stone, and I'm okay with considering some changes, that it doesn't have to, you know, it hasn't stayed stagnant
Indeed.
For 100 years, and it can so if the alphabet groups want to get together and debate raising the cruiserweight limit to 210, let's say,
sure.
maybe I could live with that. I don't know that it makes sense or makes anything better, but I could probably wrap my mind around that as not a disaster. Nobody needs an 18th division when we already have 17, especially one that we agree will carry no prestige and that we agree has a really stupid sounding name.
We want young Bridger to film a PSA.
Yes.
Campaigning against this.
If Bridger comes out against this, maybe that will be what's necessary to shut it down.
Yeah, that's what that says everything about the sport and the business, that we're vaguely relying on the
6-year-old boy to come out and save us all here. Yes. But there you go. All right. That will do it for this edition of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. Once again, our thanks to Stephen Espinosa for joining us. We will be back next week when we will be joined by our friend Brian Campbell, who will join us to talk about the first offering from Ring City. And to look ahead with us, Daniel Dubois, Joe Joyce, to which we're very much looking forward. Daniel Jacobs, Gabe Rosado, to which we're not especially looking forward. And God help us, it's almost here. The Mike Tyson, Roy Jones exhibition looks like it might actually be a thing, and we might have to talk about it. So that should be a fun episode. So join us then, won't you? And until then, thank you for listening. Be safe, be kind, and be well.